So it's kind of one of those ideas where, you know, at the same point, and I think that was sort of the theme that I was going with a little bit today, was that, you know, we have some major issues in general. That's the reason that we do this show, that we have to deal with the environment, but that it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, all glum. We talk about on the show sometimes about, you know, things like activist burnout or the feeling of helplessness that people generally have. And I think that was a lot of what the idea behind Power Shift was to give people the energy to and the confidence, and not just the information, but the energy to maybe find some practical ways to deal with some of these problems.
Yeah, exactly. So bringing a bunch of people together, giving them the skills they need to succeed, but also connecting them. You know, so our plan for Power Shift doesn't end at Power Shift. We want people to go back home and mobilize in their communities, ideally with the people that they've met at the conference.
Absolutely. And I believe we have Kevin on the line there now. Kevin, are you there?
Hi, Darren.
Absolutely. All right. Minor technical difficulties. So we were just kind of just, what I wanted to do now was sort of talk just generally about some of the ideas, and Amara, we can certainly keep mentioning Power Shift, but just the change focus a little bit from the event itself to some of the things that Power Shift is going to be dealing with. And I know Kevin had a particular issue today that he wanted to bring up. If you want to go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I just wanted to bemoan in general the complete and mystifying political inertia regarding taking any kind of action on climate change. You know, just looking back over the summer we just had, two-thirds of the United States was under drought conditions. Food prices went up. I was at my cottage north of Kingston, and the water in the lake was extremely low. I've never seen it so low. And it just sort of brought it home, you know, that what we're seeing is exactly what the climate change models have always been predicting. We're seeing droughts, we're seeing forest fires, we're seeing an increase in the severity of storms and the frequency of storms. And to go through the drought-like conditions that we just went through this summer, and to not see that as a warning sign to a threat, a vital existential threat to our ability to grow food, just completely blows my mind. And I'm here to start today to just kind of remind people to, you know, look up the email address of your MP and you know, and email the PMO and just let people know that you want action taken on climate change. The Harper government is never going to lift a finger. They're moving in the opposite direction. They're closing down scientific research on the topic. And it's just, you know, the signs are all around us. We can see it happening right now. It's no longer a boogeyman of the future. It's occurring right now, and it's threatening civilization. You can't have civilization without the ability to grow food, especially on a planet as crowded as this one. And if we can't take that threat seriously, then we deserve what we get.
So, America, I started off the beginning of the program with a clip we played from the Post Carbon Institute, with them explaining sort of from a policymaker standpoint, just even the specific issue of peak oil, which is one of the many kind of bricks in the climate change castle, as it were. But one of the preamble that I gave there was around the idea that policymakers, a lot of the time, people assume that, you know, people in government are their job. So the person who's in charge of the environment office at whatever given time, you know, is put that in that position because they're an expert on the environment. But as far as I understand, in reality, that's not necessarily true. A lot of the time, they're actually quite, you know, maybe have some experience in that field, but they're largely ignorant and rely on things like lobbyists and the public and briefs from government scientific and policy research agencies to give them the information about which is based on their jobs and what they exactly do. And so I think one of the things that I find unconstructive is when I hear people talk about, government isn't entirely corrupt and this is just a big old boys club and thing. And I don't disagree that there's probably a component of that. But I think to another degree, you know, when we talk about activist burnout or people feeling as you said, Kevin, the inertia of not knowing what to do or the problem seeming too big and therefore people just end up doing nothing. I want to just make the appeal here that affects, you know, people in government, whether we like to think of them all the time as this way or not, are people too, and therefore are still subject to, I don't know what to do about this, therefore I'm just going to keep doing what I've always been doing because, you know, I have some incentives to do that and I don't know how to deal with the problem even if I was going to deal with it. I just wondered if I could get a comment from you on that, Amara.
Sure. I mean, I think the climate crisis that we're talking about here and the science behind it isn't disputed. The science is very clear. There was a pretty terrifying, actually, article by Bill McKibben in Rolling Stone a couple of weeks ago that basically said that we're planning to burn 5 times the amount of carbon that we have the room to burn. There's absolutely no choice but to shift away. The question we need to ask ourselves is, why is our government, instead of shifting away, choosing to continue building pipelines, continue giving fossil fuel companies $1.4 billion a year? It's not even like... if there is the acknowledgement that the science is clear, which I think there is, why are we continuing to invest in this infrastructure that's going to lock us into expanding the tar sands and continuing to burn fossil fuels and extract fossil fuels? And then I think when you look at it that way, it's what you were saying earlier about lobbying. It's pretty clear who has preferential access to the government and who is dictating the government's policy. And that's not because MPs are bad people. It's because of who has the access, who has the money. The citizens don't have the kind of organized money to influence government, which is why we need organized people. And well, I guess that's my power shift plug. But the relentless drive to put short-term economic profit over the interests of our communities, of the environment, is what's causing the problem. It's the same cause of the economic crisis. Yeah, it's pretty clear to me. I don't think emailing our MPs is going to stop it. I think we need to get organized and start building alternatives in our community and finding creative ways to put pressure on decision makers.
Sure. I mean, that being said, for your average person or for instance, for someone who doesn't have the time, money, or energy to go out and join something like PowerShift or join a larger organization, I certainly think, like, you know, 100,000 people that can't attend PowerShift sending an email to their MP is probably a good place to start. It at least lets them know that it's not just the 20 people banging on their door of their office that are concerned about it, but that those 20 people represent a larger, you know, understanding of the citizens of Canada.
Yeah, of course.
That was sort of your PowerShift answer. Can I ask you to not speak for CYCC? Just to ask your personal opinion. In your own words, where do you find that problem lies? Where for you does the balance in your experience between inertia based on ignorance and inertia based on, you know, perhaps going up to corruption, but maybe just, we'll say, influence at the very least end. Having dealt with government officials several times before, do you feel like there's more of a balance towards they're just ignorant of the fact that there's a problem, ignorant of the fact that maybe they know there's a problem, but they're ignorant of the solutions, to just it's easier to not to do anything about it, it's put it on the problem on someone else, to all the way at the other far end to just outright corruption? Where on the line in your experience would you put why we haven't been making some of these changes?
I mean, I think on the government side, it's what I said earlier. I think the people influencing the policy are the ones with the most money and the most vested interest in the status quo. And based on meetings with government officials, meetings with Canada's lead negotiators who are going to the UN, where we've presented alternative policy positions and solutions, they know it's the problem, they know the science is clear, and they know what they could do about it, and they'll be the first ones to tell you that that what they have to negotiate is dictated by a couple of people at the top. And it's completely political. Then the question is, what do we do about that? And I think the average person doesn't necessarily know what to do. So the news is telling you that Arctic ice melt has reached an all-time high, extreme weather is costing us billions of dollars. It's pretty gloomy. Then you ask yourself, what do we do? You send an email to your MP, nothing happens. You keep engaging with the system in ways where they've set the rules. So they say, okay, maybe if you email me, I'll do something about it. Write a petition. I'll do something about it. And then when that doesn't work, we just try it again. That's not working. I think we just need to get creative. So whether that's figuring out how to start a community energy project or taking action in another way, it's giving people the tools and the time that they need to get organized together and build a solution. And I totally hear what you're saying about not everyone having the time to do that, and that's fine, because we can all contribute to it in different ways. If there are a few people emailing an MP, and then in that MP's riding, there's a community energy project springing up, there are ways for them to work together to make it impossible for the MP to say no to the project.
And I think under what you're talking about organizing is, you know, a way to do this, if there's, say, 20 interested people, I mean, obviously there's a lot more, but just to keep it simple, say there's 20 interested people and 15 of them don't have time to, you know, actually go and do anything, or maybe aren't motivated to actually do anything, but they're willing to, say, write an email to their MP, and then you've got five folks who want to go down and actually speak to the MP or you know, stand outside their office or whatever it may be, is that one of the ways that we're kind of organizing around doing this is to, you know, organize it such that those 15 people that send emails, send them all in the same day, the day before that the five people show up at the office, such that you sort of have a more of an impact from those emails rather than an email every 3 days in between 700 emails from the oil lobbyists, as far as being that sort of idea. Kevin, I want to get your input on that as well, having heard Amara's response. So if the minimum people can do is send an email, then definitely go ahead and send an email. But where do you see there being maybe some real traction here, kind of on actually getting some changes happening based on what Amara said?
Well, you know, ultimately this is a political problem. Like, to go back to what you're saying, you know, ministers are humans too, and perhaps they're ignorant on the topic. I'd like to just sort of point out that the Harper government is becoming willfully ignorant. They're closing monitoring stations. They're stifling press releases from their own, from government scientists on topics like climate change. They, you know, just look at what they did to the long form census. They want to build prisons, but crime is going down. Well, get rid of the statistics that say crime is going down and build the prisons anyway. Like, they're willfully ignorant, and especially so on the topic of climate change. And as to what gets traction, you know, especially when you're dealing with a government like Harper's that is, like I said, you know, has chosen to become willfully ignorant on the topic of climate change. You know, we've got to start voting the environment. There's just no other way around it. The grassroots actions are great, and people are buying into it. You know, people are sort of on a grassroots level buying into the environment, but these issues are too large to be solved by an aggregate of small actions. We need national leadership. We need national programs. We need national targets for carbon emissions. We need national strategies. We need the tax code. We need to put a price on carbon, which can't be accomplished sensibly on a province by province basis without discouraging, without ramifications for business investment. We need to start voting the environment, and we need to especially get over this false dichotomy that it's either the environment or the economy. You know, as soon as the environment has been tracking higher and higher in recent polls as a top of mind issue in the elections, but as soon as there's a ripple in the economy, people go freaking and running in the other direction and start voting what they perceive to be, you know, the steady path for economic stewardship, which in this case bought us a Harper majority. And it's a false dichotomy, and it's not a choice between the environment and the economy. In fact, without a functioning environment, there is no economy. We just go back to what I said about being able to grow food. What will happen to our economy when there's a drought over our breadbasket? So we need to, you know, ultimately I think the solutions are political. I think the Green Majority is doing its part in trying to educate people with regards to what's going on in the world with respect to environmental issues, and hopefully, you know, people are going to start voting. I say green, not meaning the Green Party, but voting green in the sense that they're going to vote for the party with the strongest environmental platform.
Could I respond to that?
Please, go ahead.
Kevin, I feel like what you're saying is that we just need to give up our agency, you know, like vote once every few years and trust that the decision makers are going to do it for us. And, I mean, of course we should vote, but I don't think it ends there, because just focusing on voting reinforces the kind of inertia that we've been talking about, where people feel like the only legitimate way to engage with their decision makers or engage in democracy is to check something off at the ballot box, and that's not true. And if that were true, even if the more progressive parties were elected, they probably still wouldn't be doing enough. There needs to be pressure. There needs to be, like, we still need community projects. We still need grassroots movements. If there's one thing that the students in Quebec have shown us, it's that direct democracy can work, and that mass mobilization can actually make a difference.
One of the things, one of the news stories we covered about a year ago that I think is very relevant here was there was an MP from Quebec, actually, who came out speaking very publicly about, he made a comment, I forget the actual specifics of the event, but made a very public comment about how he thought climate change was a hoax. And this was, you know, very recently. And it was amazing how quickly the, he was a conservative MP, and amazing how quickly the Harper government sort of distanced himself slash made public statements about, we don't support this and whatnot. And I think there's one of two kind of conclusions that can be taken from that. Either they understand that climate change is an extremely real threat, and that there is, you know, a massive amount of science behind it, and that this is a very legitimate issue. They're simply choosing not to do anything about it, but they do recognize that it is an actual fact. Or the other possibility that I see is that they aren't even thinking about it in terms of, is this a fact or is this not a fact? It's that they simply are thinking about it in terms of voters, and that they understand slash think that voters see this as a legitimate issue, and they dare not badmouth it openly because of a voting backlash. And I think that if the second one is true, I think they're both true, but I think the second one is the important point there, is that kind of as a summation of what you're both saying there, is that, you know, yes, of course, you have to vote for the most progressive option that's there as far as environment, because it does relay back to the economy and it does relay back to all these other issues. But I think, Amara, what you're saying is that in between voting, you have an ability to actually affect what are in those platforms when it comes time to vote on them. And the only way that you're going to give even people who, you know, with the... say the famous failure of the carbon tax, the liberal platform a couple of years ago, was that the parties need to be convinced, they need to be given the confidence that people are actually going to support these policies before they have the courage to present these policies. And I think that's more what you're speaking to. Am I sort of close, Tamara?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I think, Kevin, what you said about the false dichotomy between environment and economy, that's something that the Harper government has done very well, setting up that dichotomy in order to be able to campaign on the economy as something that will suffer if we take action on the environment. It's a very deliberate political choice that they don't want to take action on the environment for whatever reason. I personally think it's because the oil companies run their platform, but that the only reason they would create that false dichotomy is because they want to be able to drive their economic platform.
Yeah, and I think we're just running out of time here. Kevin, I'll give you a quick last word in a second, but I think the kind of point here that we're all trying to make is that, this is really irrelevant, you know, which party you're talking about. You could be a conservative voter, you can be a liberal voter, you can be an NDP voter, you can be a Green Party voter. It doesn't really matter. If any of these parties saw that it was to their political advantage, that it would get them votes to have green aspects to their platforms, they would have it in about 0.2 seconds. And that doesn't, it really doesn't matter what political party you're talking about, you know, and I think that was sort of what I was getting at with that point about the conservative MP being backed away from very, very quickly when he was saying that climate change was a hoax, because they recognize that message is not going to resonate with the majority of even their voters. But anyway, Kevin, I'll give you we've got about a minute left. I'll give you the last word.
Well, just to speak to something that your guest commented on, I'd hate to be perceived as discouraging community activism and grassroots activism with regards to environmental issues. Certainly, like but I believe they're effective when they're sort of lobbying efforts and when they do what you're saying, showing politicians that it's in their best interest to provide us with green policies and a green platform. Grassroots activism is important. You know, it's a fundamental tenet of the environmental movement to think globally and act locally. So I would hate to be perceived as discouraging those kinds of actions, but I think ultimately they have to be aimed at altering the political structure to be effective.
All right. And so that is all the time that we have. I want to thank our guests very much again, Amara, for joining us with CYCC and PowerShift. Do you want to give us the website quickly for PowerShift?
Sure, yeah. It's wearePowerShift.ca, and the email address for the Toronto group is toronto.powerShift@gmail.com.
Awesome.
Well, organizing free buses.
We've talked a lot about some of the issues that's going on. Amara gave us a very good option about one of the ways to deal with that problem.